Any questions from the last time? All right. So before I close the section of the algebra and move on to geometry, a few definitions are in order. And so let's define a simple Lie group. So what's a simple Lie group? So it's a non-abelian Lie group which does not have a non-trivial normal subgroup, or I should say a proper, that's probably better. So the group itself is always a subgroup, so is the normal Lie subgroup. And the identity element is also a proper subgroup. So we are excluding those. So a simple Lie group may have, and they usually do, like a discrete normal subgroups. Okay. So the simple Lie groups and their counterpart, the simple Lie algebras, form kind of the atoms of group theory, Lie group theory. So it's an important concept, and I'll give you an example. Well, let me give an example now. It's the group SU2 is an example of that. So to define the other important concept, we need the idea of an invariant subalgebra for Lie algebras. So what's an invariant subalgebra? Suppose we have some Lie algebra G tilde and K tilde is a subalgebra or a subset of G, K tilde is a subset of G, such that if you take an element of K tilde and evaluate its commutator with any element of the Lie algebra, it gives you another element either of K tilde or it commutes. If K tilde satisfies this kind of commutation relationship, then we say that K tilde is an invariant subalgebra. So using this notion, we can define what is a simple Lie algebra. So if a So there's a, sorry, type in my notes. If a Lie algebra has no say non-trivial invariant subalgebra, then we say it is simple. And the Lie algebra of SU2 is an example. So simple Lie groups, simple Lie algebras give rise to simple Lie groups. And vice versa. Of course, if I give you a Lie algebra, it doesn't always, it doesn't specify completely what the Lie group is going to be. An example is if I give you an, like an abstract sort of Lie algebra of SU2, you know, it could, you know, it could lead to a group which is SU2 or SO3.
Yeah. Does a proper subgroup have to be the opposite discrete?
Sorry?
Does a proper subgroup have to not be discrete?
Proper normal Lie subgroup.
The Lie subgroup, okay.
Yeah, but if you're Lie, yeah, exactly. So, exactly. It can have a proper, it can have a subgroup, which is, and actually SU2 does have a lot of discrete subgroups.
Okay.
And for example, I think the Z2 is a proper subgroup of SU2. So, you know, the elements of this form in SU2, you know, they form a proper discrete subgroup, for example.
I think that yesterday at some point we wrote in the blackboard that the adjoint representation was irreducible, but with the definition of a simple Lie algebra, it is clear that that's
it's not
really the case for simple Lie algebras.
Irreducible.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can actually prove that for a simple Lie algebra, the adjoint representation, it's really just a page. It's really simple.
The irreducibility, not yeah. The definition. Because if you see invariantness,
yeah,
an invariant algebra.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
K is an invariant subalgebra if it is invariant under the adjoint representation of the Lie algebra.
Right, yeah.
With
yeah.
its definition.
Yeah.
So if we have no invariant subspaces, that's the definition of irreducibility.
All right, so abelian subalgebras are pesky things. And so there's another definition which is important is abelian invariant subalgebras and so, an abelian invariant subalgebra is a subalgebra that commutes with the whole Lie algebra. It's when the comment is, you know, when a group has a U1 subgroup, and that's when we get abelian invariant subalgebras So using this definition, there is another important concept that we can define, and the definition is of a semi-simple Lie algebra. So a Lie algebra that doesn't contain any abelian invariant subalgebra is called a semi-simple or semi-simple if you're an American Lie algebra. So example of a semi-simple Lie algebra is the Lie algebra of SO4. So the Lie algebra of SO4, you can show quite easily, consists of two, you know, mutually commuting SU2 Lie algebras. And so SO4 is closely related to the Lorentz group, SO1,3. It's kind of an analytic continuation, if you like. So if you think of the Lorentz group, you have three boosts and three rotations. And by combining those three boosts with these three rotations in a complex linear combination, you can show that the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group looks very much like the Lie algebra. It's actually the Lie algebra of two SU2s. So, and SO4 is very similar, except instead of eta, you have delta, right? So anyway,
Could you explain that comment, want a group as you want?
Oh.
As?
It as, yes. So because of this, you know, you can see that it does have invariant subalgebra, right? This SU2 is an invariant subalgebra. This SU2 is an invariant, because this guy commutes with this guy. But it doesn't have an abelian invariant subalgebra. Okay, and therefore it's a semi-simple. So this is SO4 is semi-simple, but not simple. So, and also semi-simple Lie groups. So in the classification of Lie groups, which unfortunately we won't get into unless people want it badly, and I can come back later in the year to give us a couple of special lectures on, say, tensors, SUN tensors, Young tableau, and classification of Lie algebras. Maybe between QFT1 and QFT2, because you really only need group theory Lie groups in QFT2 and beyond. So one possibility is that for me to come back between QFT1 and QFT2 and have a couple of lectures for those who want to take it on those topics, advanced topics.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, could you explain again what's the U1 subgroup?
All right, so for example, you can have UN, say, and then if you restrict the determinant to one, you get SUN. So there is actually, in UN, there's a U1 which commutes with everything else. within the group, and that's the one that is going to be, you know, that it's going to give you the U1 factor, okay? And by restricting the determinant to be one, we eliminate that one, that U1. So this is an example where, you know, it's not semisimple. UN is not semisimple because it'll have a U1 factor. And at the level of the Lie algebra, whatever the generator of the U1 is, it's going to commute with everything else. You know, any structure constant involving the U1 will be zero. So at the Lie algebra level, it kind of completely decouples from the rest of the. All right, so my aim today is to get to the representation theory of SU2, which many of you have seen. But every year, we get a few students who haven't seen that. So it's worth doing. But before that, I want to spend a little bit of time discussing some applications of group theory to manifolds. All right. So intuitively, at least, it should be clear that S2, the two-sphere, is symmetric under SO3, right? Because, you know, one way to generate the two-sphere is to take a vector and apply all the rotations on it. And the tip of that vector will basically, you know, generate a surface, which is S2. So if you apply if you apply SO3 to any point on this on S2, where you think of any point in S2 as the tip of a position vector emanating from the center of the sphere, then you're going to get to another point in SU2. So rotations of S2 are given by the symmetry of S2 are given by SO3. Okay. So there's a lot of applications of groups on manifolds. To formalize it, one needs to define the group action. See. The group action on a manifold. So what I told you is just an example of a group action. There could be other group actions. For example, the Lie group itself is a manifold, and there's a group action there because if you just left multiply any element with another element, that's an action of the group on the manifold. So in general, you know, let G be a Lie group and M be a manifold. Then the action of G on M is a map sigma which maps us from G times M to M, such that if you take the identity element of the group and apply it on some point P, then you get the same point P back for all points in M. And the number two is the group action can be composed. So suppose you apply two group elements on the point P, then that is going to be given by the multiplication of these two group elements being applied to P. And so this, for example, means that if I take the sphere, you know, and I rotate here this way and then this way, you know, the composition of the two rotations, if I apply it at the same time, it takes that point to the same point, you know. So it's just making formal something that is intuitively clear. Okay, so the example we saw, there could be other examples. So for example, let x be some position vector in Rn. So, and g is some element of, say, GL NR, then the action of G on X could be the action of the matrix G acting on X. You know, so similarly, we can define the action of SON on an SN minus 1 sphere. So similarly, define action of SON. You can think of SO3 in your mind, say, on some SN minus 1 sphere. Think of SU2. So group actions can be free or transitive. So what does this term mean? Okay. So an action is transitive. So if for any points P1 and P2 in M, you know, there exists an element G, you know, such that you can get to P1 get from P1 to P2, then the action of the action is transitive. So transitivity means that all points on M can be reached by action of the group. For example, SO3 acts transitively on S2. If I start from the North Pole, I can go to any other point on the two-sphere by applying some group element, right? However, if you take SO2, which is a subgroup of SO3, and SO2 are rotations around a given axis, a single axis, so take the SO2 rotation that is around the z-axis, right? Now that point, that group is not going to take you, cannot take you to any point on the two-sphere. It can only take you around, you can only take a point to another point on a circle. The North Pole, it doesn't even, and the South Pole, it doesn't even move, right? So SO2 does not act transitively on S2. And then action can be free as well, just like the coffee, except when it's not there. But that's still free, right? If you're not getting something, even if you pay for it. So if for every G, that is not equal to the identity element, sigma has no fixed point. I'll define what a fixed point is. Then we say the action is free. So, for example, fixed point means that, so it means that if, for example, if there, if there exists, okay, if for P on M, we have sigma some group element acting on P, but then we get back P, then G must be the identity element. So if this is true, then we say the action is free. So what it means is that if you take a non-trivial group element and you apply it on the points of the, on all the points of the group, it has to move. It cannot remain itself. So examples of free action is, so the action of the translation group say on four-dimensional Minkowski space is free, because if you are translating by a non-trivial amount, the point does not remain, goes to some other point. Now, what is an example of an action that is not free? So, action of SO3 on S2 is not free because, for example, hang on, what am I saying? Yeah. So because there exists some rotations that leave some of the points unchanged. So for example, the SO2 rotation leaves the north and the south pole unchanged. So those are fixed points of some rotation, of some elements. So you can always find there are points P for which there is G such that this is satisfied when G is not equal to E. So because, say, North Pole is fixed, is a fixed point under rotations around the z-axis. So this actually takes us to a very important notion of a subgroup called the little group or the stabilizer. Can see that the little group is probably not a mathematician term. It's also known as the isotropy group, not to be confused with the isometry group. Okay, little group or stabilizer. Sometimes called stabilizer, sometimes called stabilizer group, sometimes called isotropy group. I wish I could write with both hands. My arm is getting tired. All right, what is the little group? So let G be a Lie group that acts on M. So the little group of the point P of M is the subgroup of G such that subgroup, let's call it H, and it's a function of the point P, such that it consists of those elements of G such that the action of those elements on P is a fixed point. The P is a fixed point of that action. So again, example is S2, take a S2, take our manifold to be S2, and take the north pole, say P is this thing. So then the subgroup of then the SO2 subgroup of SO3, you know, which has the form one 0, 0, 0, 0, cosine of theta, sine of theta, cosine of theta, you know, leaves, okay, is a little group, is the little group of P. So whenever we have a little group, and you can actually verify that this definition satisfies the group property. So whenever we have a little group, we can define a coset manifold. So instead of going through the more general definition of a coset manifold, I'm just going to give an example. The coset space SO3 over S2 is actually the two sphere, and I will show that now. So before that, just some general remarks. You know, let us consider, say, the coset. Just reminding you what a coset is. So if G1 and G2 for some G satisfies G1 equals to G2 of H, you know, for some H in the subgroup, you know, then we say G1 is equivalent to G2. In other words, G1 and G2 belong to the same coset. Now suppose that, G1 is not equivalent to G2, so that is, they don't belong to the same coset. So this is not an X. What I mean is this is, I'm negating that. but G1 is close to G2. So they're points which are close to each other. So then we can say, then the, you know, this notion, see, then we can say that their cosets are also close to K is a portmanteau of can and say. Can say that G1 of H is close to G2 of H. That these are nearby. And G2 are nearby. In other words, the notions of continuity that we had in the group manifold is extended to the coset space. And of course, this is not a proof, but this is an argument that the coset space is also a manifold. Okay. So the coset space is also a manifold. So now let's come to our example. We want to show that the two sphere can be thought of as SO3 over SO2. And this is a very important example that can be generalized to many, many, many different spaces. In fact, one of the first important applications of group theory was the classification of, you know, spaces using the coset construction. So let's take the North Pole and consider say all rotations around the z-axis. So they leave. So they leave EZ invariant. So okay, let me just erase the last line. Let's call this subgroup H, and H, you know, leaves EZ invariant. So by now you should be familiar with this. So what I mean is that if you have an H that acts on EZ, you get EZ for all H in big H. So now if G1 and G2, you know, belong to the same coset, then we say that G1 is equal to G2H for some H in, so this is, this H is SO2. Now, if I apply G1 on EZ, we can write this as G2H acting on EZ, but H acting on EZ just leaves it invariant, so this is equal to G2 of EZ. Okay. So you see, G1 can take the North Pole to some other point. Say, let's call that point P. But G2, sorry, sorry, G2H can take North Pole to some other point, say P. But G1 also takes the North Pole to that point. Okay? So we can associate this whole coset to that point. So. And this shows you that for every point on your manifold, there is a point on your coset space. And vice versa.
Tuba?
Yeah?
Don't we have a problem because of the fact that for minus EZ, so not the south pole, we have the same little group? So, I mean, it's not a one-to-one, it's...
Right. The little group is the same, you're right. But you know, I'm saying is that, you know, there would be... Right. Yeah, but why would that be a problem then? Because, you know, you could still have elements take the North Pole to South Pole, and the South Pole would also, you know, correspond to, you know, so if you have, there would be different elements taking the North Pole to the South Pole, and they could be related by H, and they would still belong to the same coset.
Yes, so if we go from the coset space, if you start from the sphere,
yeah,
two points that goes to the same element of the coset, the same coset. So we have not a one-to-one, we have...
Oh, I see. You're saying...
we have to identify the transpose, I guess.
No, I don't think so. I think what's happening is you identify the North Pole with the identity element, but the way that you are measuring, you are identifying the group elements with the different cosets is by an action on the north pole. And the action on the north pole that takes you to south pole is not the identity element.
What's the word before coset element? Point on S2.
We can associate to each point on S2 to a whole, to a whole coset element. Okay. I mean, this argument shows that you can think of group cosets of Lie groups as the manifold that the numerator of the coset is a symmetric group to. And this has lots of applications. So for example, you can think of, so SON plus 1 over SON, you know, gives you SN, for example. And you know, such spaces are called homogeneous spaces. And in physics, you know, for example, they play an important role. For example, the ADS space that is you hear so much about in string theory or in holography, that's also a coset space. I forget exactly what the coset is. It's something like SON minus 1 comma 2 over SON minus 1 comma 1, I think, I think that's it. So that you can think of, and so this is the symmetric group of the ADS space. So this is a very, very nice and interesting construction. The dimension of your manifold.
Sorry, why do we call this space homogeneous space? So their relation to the homogeneous.
Right. I mean, essentially, you know, the. So think of homogeneous cosmologies, right? So for example, we say that, you know, our universe space is spatially homogeneous. And that means that you can, what does this mean? So if it's a flat universe, we basically say that we can, you know, it has some translation symmetry, right? So, but if it was spherically symmetric, we mean that any point on the sphere can be taken to any point on the sphere, right? And that it's you know, that so homogeneity is essentially meaning that it has a lot of symmetry.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a coset structure. So
yes. So the space. This is a, what do you mean is a coset structure?
I want to say that I don't know what is the relation between the coset and the homogeneous. I think homogeneous don't need to be a coset of.
Homogeneous. Oh, you're saying homogeneous spaces don't need to be coset spaces. Yes, you're right, but they could be trivial cosets, probably. It's okay. I'm not sure, but I think it is. It has to be a coset, but you know, I may be wrong. But I think it has to be a coset space. Can you give me an example of a space? Well, if it's okay, let's see. If it's non-compact, then probably you're right. For example, I don't know if I can think of, say, the Minkowski space as a coset of. Or Euclidean space as a coset of two groups. But if it's something compact, then I think this is probably one of the, but yeah.
Spaces are homogeneous.
Sorry?
the conclusion that the question is if all spaces are homogeneous.
So, you know, I mean, I'm saying that these spaces are called homogeneous spaces, but he's saying that not all homogeneous spaces are coset constructions.
Oh.
Yes. And I think that, you know, you're right in the sense that I cannot think of say the non-Minkowski space. Minkowski space is kind of a special example. I don't know of how you can think of it as a coset space, but ADS is also a non-complex space, and we can think of it as a homogeneous space, you know, as a coset, right? So anyway, what is the dimension of the coset? Is the dimension of the coset space is the dimension of the group minus the dimension of H. Okay. So before I move on to discuss the representation theory, I want to mention one last idea from geometry that is important. And I think, you know, one way of thinking of Minkowski space as a coset would be to take, or like a Euclidean space, is to take one of these coset construction and take the radius to go to infinity. But
I mean, I thought that the definition of homogeneous space was that it was a coset.
That's what I thought, but he's saying that it's not. So. And that's because it admits a nice group action, right?
Yeah, for me, a homogeneous space is a space in which there's a group that acts transitively.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you repeat that same construction and you can
yeah.
build it
yeah.
as a coset.
Yeah. All right, so a little bit of geometry before we. So you can define, there's a natural notion of a metric on a Lie group. So there's a right. So there are these left invariant one form. So suppose you take a group element and take apply the derivative operator on it. So such, and then on the left multiplied by G inverse, this is called a left invariant form. And that's because if you apply on G from the left H, where H is some constant, meaning that you're not varying H, then this thing remains invariant. So given these forms, you can take a trace and this will be proportional to the coordinates two differential of the coordinates of your manifold. And because you're tracing, there is no matrix on this end, but the coefficient is a metric tensor. And this metric tensor is known as the left invariant metric. And all the nice things that you get out of a metric, you can get out of this, such as you can define a volume form, you can define curvature. So you can basically do all the differential geometry that you did, that, you know, which involves the use of a metric, you can do this on a group manifold. If you do this calculation for SO3, you get the usual round metric on the three sphere. Okay. Okay, so this is all I have to say for about geometry. And before I move on to finite dimensional irreducible representation of SU2, but any more questions?
I don't get what the symbols mean here. You said that there's a left invariant form, and then, like, what do the next two lines mean?
Oh, okay. So that means that suppose you, apply H on G in this way. So you apply it from the left, but you're considering H to be something constant, meaning that you're holding it constant. And then if you say, okay, then what happens is that this thing becomes G inverse H inverse, and this thing is D of H of G. But because H is, you're fixing it, you're holding it fixed, means that this thing comes to the derivative operator and cancels H inverse. And so this thing remains invariant, and that's why it's called a left invariant metric. Left invariant one form. And this is still a matrix, so it has some form. You can show that this is actually an element of the Lie algebra, as well as it has, in some coordinate system, it has a differential element dx mu, and there is some function which depends on the point you're in, which kind of sews them together. So this guy is, this is actually equal to this. And, so you can think of this as a one form on the tangent space, okay? Or more precisely, the cotangent space. And there's a lot one can go there, but I'm just not gonna do that. It's lack of time. All right, so let's move on to the representation theory of SU2. As I said, many of you have seen this before, but it's worth doing. One of those things that you just need to know if you're a physicist. Also, one thing is that the techniques here play a very, very important role in building up the representation theory for general groups. So let's start with the Lie algebra of SU2. And I'm going to borrow the language from spin a lot. So I'm going to write them as JA, although I'm doing group theory, but I'm going to borrow the language from quantum mechanics a lot. So what this means is that I realized yesterday that some of you actually haven't seen the Levi-Civita symbol before. So what this means is this set of commutation relationship. Now we can define something called the ladder operators. So what is the ladder operator? What are the ladder operators? There are two operators we call J plus and J minus, and they're a complex combination of J1 and J2. So the plus sign requires to this plus sign, the minus sign to this minus. So the J plus minus, they are not Hermitian. Because we take J1, J2, J3 to be Hermitian. So we take J1, J2, J3 be Hermitian. Then what we have is that if you take the dagger of J plus, you get J minus. And if you take the dagger of J minus, you get J plus because of the I. So the Lie algebra in terms of this new set, so the new set is J plus, J minus, and J3. We are leaving J3 as it is. It's J3, J plus minus gives you plus minus J plus minus. You can verify this very easily in two lines. And the commutator of J plus and J minus is 2 times J3. Now, yesterday we discussed about, we talked about the Cartan subalgebra. So the rank of SU2 is 1, meaning that there's only one element of the Cartan subalgebra. And we could have chosen any of these one, J1, J2, J3, to be the Cartan subalgebra. But it's conventional to choose J3 to be that Cartan subalgebra. So conventional to choose J3 to be the Cartan. Okay. Also, We discussed Schur's lemma, and Schur's lemma tells us that if an operator commutes with all the other, you know, operators, then it's actually identity proportional to the identity, and you can show that the J squared, which is defined as J dot J, that is J1 squared plus J2 squared plus J3 squared, that this guy commutes, so this commutes with all the J's. So that means that on whatever representation we are going to discuss, it will be proportional to the identity matrix. And such operators are also known as Casimir invariants. And they label the whole representation. In the optional section of tutorial 2, there are some discussion of the Casimir operator of the Poincaré group, which is P squared, and there's another one called the Pauli-Lubansky spin vector, anyway. Okay, so how do we build up the representation from this, from essentially from this one commutation relationship? So let's start with an eigenstate of J3. Eigenvector, I mean. So although I'm using the bracket notation, I'm actually doing linear algebra and group theory. I'm not doing quantum mechanics yet. So J3 acting on M gives me the eigenvalue M. And because J3 is real, the eigenvalue, J3 is Hermitian, the eigenvalue is real. So what are the interpretation of J plus and J minus? Well, to find that, let's apply J plus to some state, to some vector M, and then measure its J3 eigenvalue. So using that commutation relationship, this guy, we can write this as J plus J3 M plus J plus of M. But M, J3 acting on the ket M gives me just M according to this thing. So I can pull that M out, and there's a one here, and I have J plus of M. So what this tells us is that J plus acting on M, the state, the vector M, raises the vector M's J3 eigenvalue by one, right? So we can say that J plus acting on M should be proportional to the vector M plus one. But there has to be some proportionality constant. Let's call that M CM plus one. So this is some constant of proportionality or normalization. It's proportionality. Okay. So similarly, if you apply J3 on J minus acting on M, we get M minus 1 of J minus acting on M. So thus, we see that J minus decreases the J3 eigenvalue by 1. So we have a picture now. Well, before we do that, let's say J minus acting on M is giving me M minus 1, and let's call the proportionality constant dM minus 1. So a picture emerges, and the picture is something like this. We have a ladder, and somewhere on the ladder is a state which is labeled by a J3 eigenvalue. So this is the J3 ladder. And then above it is the M plus 1 eigenvalue rung, M plus 2. It goes up. And then there's M minus 1, M minus 2, and it goes down. If you want to climb up the ladder, you apply J plus. If you want to climb down the ladder, you apply J minus. And hence, J plus and J minus are aptly called ladder operators. They're also called stepping operators and a few other names that I forget. Physicists love them, mathematicians also love them. Okay, so so we assume that if we have 10 minutes. 1, 2. Okay, I might run over by a few minutes. I'm sorry. Okay. So we assume that all the states are normalized. Then we can do this. You know, apply. M plus 1, the bra from the left, or the dual vector. And that gives me Cm plus 1, M plus 1, M plus 1. So this gives me an expression for Cm plus 1, which is M plus 1, J plus M. So now, if I take the other one, J minus this guy, J minus this acting on this, and I take the Hermitian conjugate of the whole thing, the Hermitian conjugation transforms J minus to J plus. It transforms the ket to a bra. And on the right-hand side, we have M minus 1, and then we have dm minus 1 star. Then I apply from the right the ket m. This is, of course, just a number. What have I done? Right, OK, sorry. Sorry, I've made a slight mistake. So what I'm doing is that I'm taking, one shouldn't rush with these things. We take J minus but we replace m by m plus 1. Then on the right-hand side, we have d of m, and m here, and then I conjugate it, I get m plus 1, j minus, and then I apply the ket m from the right. So we have dm star, and here we get 1 from the bracket of m. So basically, I have an expression for c, an expression for d star. And we see that they are the same, and therefore, cm plus 1 is dm star. So we have related the two different normalizations. Now, we've assumed that our representation is finite dimensional. That means that m has a possible highest value. Let's call it j. We have not, I want to point out that we have not assumed that m is an integer. M is some real number, but it has some highest possible value j, because otherwise, you know, this ladder would be an infinite ladder, right? And we are assuming that it is not. Then what that means is that if we apply j plus on the maximal state, the maximal weight state, called, then we cannot, it goes to zero. And then if I use the commutation relationship, and then sandwich it between a bra of j and bra of ket, so if I do this, then on the right-hand side, we have j plus acting on j. Of course, that is 0. And then the j3 acting on j will give me j. So I get 2j. But what is this guy? This guy is, according to our formula where, you know, this thing, right? So what is this thing? This thing is essentially saying that if I have j minus acting on m, I get cm star on m minus 1, right? I'm just writing this thing. So then this guy becomes cj squared j minus 1 j minus 1 equals to 2j. But this is just 1 because they're normalized. That means cj squared is 2j. So we have found one of the, you know, proportionality constants. Now, if I take this guy and apply it to some generic m, so if I say I want to sandwich it between m, say j plus, j minus, minus, j plus of m to m j3 of m, then we get a recursion relationship between the normalizations. Okay. So we have a recursion relationship. We have a boundary value, and then we can solve it. Right? So what is cj minus 1? So So what is according to a recursion relationship, Cj minus 1 whole squared is, we know what Cj is. So according to a recursion relationship, so in we are putting m equals to j minus 1, then on the right-hand side, we'll have 2 times j minus 1, and then cj squared, but cj squared is 2j. And we can write this as 2 times 2j minus 1. So now we've found cj minus 1 squared, we can find cj minus 2 squared. And this actually just turns out to be 2 times 3j minus 1. We can carry this until it's cj minus s. And this will be 2 times s plus 1 j minus 1 minus 2 dot minus s. But this is a series, an arithmetic series that we can sum. And if you sum it, then we get and then when the dust settles, this just becomes so we cannot actually determine the phase of this guy. We have to choose the phase. And a conventional choice is to choose them to be real and positive. So this is the solution. Now, you know, as we apply the Loring operator, you know, that application has to end at some point because again, we are assuming that it's a finite representation, and therefore, you know, the ladder cannot go all the way down to hell. It has to stop somewhere. And that means that at some point, this has to be zero. But this can only be zero if 2j is equal to s at some point. Because s is an integer, s is a positive integer. This tells us that j can take values like 0, half, 1, 3 halves. So recall, you know, what j was. J was the j was the highest. Another thing which I will not show is that you can show that the eigenvalue of the j squared operator is j times j plus 1. Okay? They're a trivial representation essentially. So j is essentially the eigenvalue of j squared, and therefore j labels the whole representation. Okay. So our nice ladder operator relationship we can write now as j plus acting on m gives me j minus of m j plus m plus 1. M plus 1, and J minus acting on M gives me J minus M. This one you can derive. Very easy. M minus 1. Okay, yeah. When M is equal to, from here we see when M is equal to minus J minus 1, then CM star is 0. So this means that, you know, the highest weight state J, if you apply J minus, you get to J minus 1. And you apply J minus operator, you get to minus J plus 1. And then if you apply J minus again, you get to minus J. If you apply J minus more, you get to 0. If you apply J plus to J minus 1, you get to J. If you apply J plus more, you get to 0. And similarly, so starting from here, so I've just taken the ladder and put it on the floor, essentially. OK? So in total, how many states do we have? We have in total, so if J is an integer, then there will be a middle state, which will be the 0. If J is half integer, there is no middle. There's an even number of states. So the total number of states is 2J plus 1. So this is the dimensionality. This is the dimensionality of the representation. As a homework, I would like you to find the J equals to 2 representation. You do it by yourself. What you do is that you take minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2, and then work out what these guys are. So there'll be 5 by 5 matrices. Okay. And I think I'll stop there.